with nutritious snacks and weekend meals. UWLakes.org/lumberjack. Looking at weather tonight, partly cloudy skies with highs 50 to 57, calm winds. Tomorrow, patchy fog early, then mostly sunny. Highs 77 to 80, evening temps in the low to mid 50s.
Let's get back to the objectivity and let the science lead us, because that's how we get to the best decisions for public health.
We speak with Dr. Daniel Jernigan, who resigned from the CDC this week after Director Susan Menares was fired.
It's Friday, August 29th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. Republicans in Texas have made significant gains with Latino voters over the past year.
A newly approved congressional map could lock those gains in.
Hispanics that supported Trump, they saw it as good for the economy, but I don't see any benefits.
Also, how to talk to children about the mass shooting in Minneapolis.
And a preview of the college football season, including who might win the Heisman.
You know, I'm grateful that y'all think that, but I've only played, two games, so I got a lot to prove.
Those stories and more coming up after this summary of the day's news.
Live from NPR News, I'm Janine Herbst. A federal judge heard arguments today on President Trump's effort to fire a member of the Federal Reserve's governing board. But as NPR's Scott Horsley reports, the judge issued no ruling.
Fed Governor Lisa Cook is challenging the president's decision, announced in a social media post, to oust her from the central bank. By law, Fed governors can only be removed for cause. Cook says unproven claims from a Trump loyalist that she made false statements on a mortgage application don't meet that standard. A Justice Department lawyer disagreed, arguing it's up to the president to decide what's a fireable offense and that judges can't second-guess that. Trump has been unusually critical of the Fed for not lowering interest rates. Critics say the attack on Cook is simply a way for Trump to exert more control over the central bank. The Fed says it will abide by any decision, but urged the court to act quickly to remove the cloud of uncertainty. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
The Gaza Health Ministry says the death toll in Gaza has passed 63,000 in the 22-month war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. This as Palestinians face the start of Israel's expanded offensive in Gaza City. The ministry says five people died from malnutrition-related causes over the past day, raising the death toll to 322, including 121 children, since the war began. Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey today praised staff from several city departments for their quick and ongoing response to the mass shooting at a Catholic church this week that left two school children dead and 18 other people, many of them children, injured. And he says personnel will be on hand next week to help children in the city as school gets underway on Tuesday.
In the coming week, we know there will be a lot of difficult emotions due to school starting for Minneapolis kids, and we will be there. Our safety teams will support and will make sure that families both are safe and that they feel safe.
Hennepin healthcare officials say at least five children, one in critical condition, and one adult remained hospitalized. Louisiana is appealing a redistricting case to the Supreme Court with a novel argument that could undermine the Federal Voting Rights Act. NPR's Hansi Lo Wong has more.
For decades, Voting Rights Act protections against racial discrimination have been mainly enforced through lawsuits filed by private individuals and groups. They include a group of black Mississippians who challenged legislative maps drawn by the state's Republican-controlled legislature. Those Mississippians argued the maps dilute the collective voting power of black voters. A three-judge court agreed. But in a Supreme Court filing, GOP state officials in Mississippi claim those Mississippians do not have a right to sue, and only the U.S. Attorney General does. Republican officials are making this novel argument in multiple redistricting lawsuits, including one out of North Dakota that the Supreme Court may decide to hear after a Louisiana case about whether Voting Rights Act protections of redistricting are constitutional. Hansi Lo Wong, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Today marks 20 years since Hurricane Katrina devastated the northern Gulf Coast, killing nearly 1,400 people. And while much of the focus is on New Orleans, where federal levees failed and flooded the city, the hurricane also decimated the Mississippi Gulf Coast, where it made landfall. NPR's Debbie Elliott has more.
Katrina slammed ashore in Waveland, Mississippi with a three-story storm surge. Former Mississippi Governor Haley Barbour says the state's entire 70-mile coastline was devastated.
When I flew over the coast in a helicopter after the hurricane, It looked like the hand of God had wiped away the coast. Utter obliteration.
Waveland is still trying to come back 20 years later, says Bernie Cullen with the city's aptly named Ground Zero Museum, noting that the downtown business district is still mostly empty.
That sense of Main Street USA is missing.
Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Waveland, Mississippi.
Drivers will get a break at the gas station this holiday weekend. Although gas prices have edged up slightly over the past few days, they are expected to average around $3.15 a gallon, according to the app Gas Buddy. That's down from $3.29 a gallon this time last year. And AAA says people in some parts of the country will find prices below $3 a gallon, including Georgia, Texas, North Carolina, and Iowa. I'm Janine Herbst, and you're listening to NPR News. From Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Imaginable Futures, funding programs in the U.S. with the goal of ensuring young children and their parents get the education they need to thrive. Learn more at imaginablefutures.com. This is NPR.
It is 6 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered this Friday afternoon here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from Bridget's Pub, located in downtown Bemidji, serving Irish and American food, offering Monday night trivia at 6:30 and open mic night on Thursday starting at 6:30. More on Facebook. And coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE KBXE news team.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. The White House has tapped a new acting leader for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention after firing its new director, Susan Menarez, earlier this week. The new director is now Jim O'Neill. He's currently the Deputy Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services. He is not a physician nor a scientist. He is a close ally of Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. In response to Menarez's dismissal, three senior officials collected their belongings and walked out of the building yesterday for good.
Let's get the politics out of public health. Let's get back to the objectivity and let the science lead us, because that's how we get to the best decisions for public health.
That is Dr. Daniel Jernigan speaking to a large crowd carrying flowers and signs. Jernigan was the director of the CDC's National Center for Emerging and Zoonotic Infectious Diseases until he resigned this week. His resignation comes after three decades at the agency. Dr. Jernigan, welcome to All Things Considered.
Thanks.
So tell us why you felt compelled to resign after such a long time at the CDC. I mean, 30 years.
Well, we have always been trying to follow evidence-based approaches to making decisions. And over the last several weeks to months, we have been presented with a process that we can't see how it is using scientific processes and doing things the way good science is done. When Dr. Menarez was fired from her position, mm-hmm. it became clear that there would not be leadership that would be able to promote that evidence-based approach to things. And for that, all three of us decided that now was the time to go.
And why do you personally believe Dr. Susan Menarez was fired from the CDC?
Yes, there are a number of rumors out there. There's different discussions that I've heard, but my understanding was that she was asked to fire myself, Dr. Deb Howery, our chief medical officer, and Dr. Daskalakis, our center director for our immunization group, and she refused to do that. In addition, I understand that she refused to sign the statements about the recommendations for COVID vaccines from the last vaccine meeting. And because of those things, that's my understanding of why she was released.
So before your resignation, you were under the assumption that you were on the chopping block eventually anyway.
That's my understanding, yeah, mm-hmm. that the outcome would be the same either way.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the new director of the CDC. In his confirmation hearing to become deputy secretary, Jim O'Neill said that he was a staunch supporter of vaccines, but he has also criticized the CDC's response to the pandemic. And now that he's been selected as acting director of the CDC, in your view, does he have what it takes to lead the agency?
So I don't know him. I don't really know his past work. However, I do know that the CDC deserves having a scientist with good public health background that understands what it means to follow good science, use processes for determining evidence, and make recommendations that can withstand the test of time.
Well, for a lot of people who are watching all of this play out, it looks like the CDC is in tremendous turmoil, to say the least. How concerned are you about the future of this agency?
I'm very concerned. This is an agency that I have worked at for 30 years. It is populated with extremely smart people that are very dedicated and who have been through a lot of different complicating and challenging times over the last many years. They will be able to have resiliency. They'll be able to get through if they are supported and can be allowed to do that. The secretary needs to help resource the Centers for Disease Control. He also needs to help have much more objective scientific work and have more transparent approaches to it. If that could be done, I don't know if the secretary wants to do that or not, but if that could be done, we could save what is the global preeminent public health agency.
Well, in the meantime, where does this leave the public? Because since President Trump took office, health agencies have, you know, faced mass layoffs, funding cuts, the gutting of federal websites. I mean, you've talked about all of this. It's left a lot of people wondering who or what to trust. So what are you personally telling your friends or your neighbors about how to make informed healthcare decisions right now? I'm sure people have approached you about that, yeah?
The CDC website has a lot of information on it that has been prepared by CDC. Most recently, some of the recommendations coming out from the secretary aren't on our website, and so much of what's on there is still very solid. However, as we go forward, I can't say if we'll be able to tell the difference between what was arrived at with evidence-based approaches versus ideology-based approaches. And so my recommendation is to be cautious, and it may be that we need to have alternatives out there that can communicate which parts of our CDC recommendations are actually the ones that you should follow.
Well, I do realize you just resigned this week, but I have to ask, what's next for you, you think?
Well, I have been in public health for over 30 years, and prior to that in internal medicine. And so I'm getting up there. I don't have to do anything.
This is retirement, resignation and retirement.
Well, it could be retirement, or it could be I get to do whatever I want at this point.
But sounds good to me.
I clearly will be working in public health because that's really what matters to me, and that's what protects Americans and protects people around the globe.
Dr. Daniel Jernigan. Earlier this week, he resigned from his position as director of the CDC's National Center for Emerging and Zoonotic Infectious Diseases. Thank you very much for your time and for your service.
Thank you very much.
Republicans made big inroads with Hispanic voters in Texas last year. Now, a newly approved redistricting plan will test the GOP's reach with Latinos and whether those gains are locked in for good. This game of Texas Hold'em could dictate if they get to keep control of the U.S. House. NPR congressional correspondent Claudia Grisales has more.
Under a broiling sun, there's a popular frozen drink stop in Seguin, Texas, known as Millie's, where locals cool off.
Just strawberry in it. This one sells pretty good, chamoy and mango.
But business owner Tomas Hernandez Jr. says the political environment here is hotter than ever. He says a lot of that has to do with the struggling economy.
A lot of the people that supported Trump, we're not expecting this to happen.
Grocery prices are high, suppliers are charging more, and laborers are leaving as the Trump administration intensifies deportations. Now, state Republicans are moving Hernandez's South Central Texas community into a new congressional district in a bid to grow their U.S. House delegation. A Democrat, Hernandez doubts many of last year's GOP voters, including his own relatives, will stay loyal.
Hispanics, whether they're my own family or non-family members that supported Trump, they saw it as good for the economy, but I don't see any benefits
Texas Governor Greg Abbott signed the new maps into law on Friday, adding five new Republican-friendly districts. Four of those new seats are Hispanic majority, testing the GOP's reach with the state's largest demographic. Longtime Texas Republican Senator John Cornyn likes to brag on his party's gains with Latino voters.
President Trump won a substantial increase in the vote of the Hispanic population.
That's Cornyn during a campaign stop at an Abilene, Texas school this week, 300 miles from Seguin. In last year's election, Trump nearly won a majority of Hispanic voters nationwide, up from roughly a third during his previous run.
As Democrats at the national level become more and more radical and more extreme, I think more Hispanics are looking to Republican candidates to vote.
But Texas Democratic Congressman Greg Kassar disagrees. During his campaign launch this week, he said Republicans will lose Latino voters. Kassar is running to represent a shrinking blue dot in Austin under the new map. His old 35th congressional district will shift south to a four-county area that includes Seguin and will be 60% Latino.
I've already heard from multiple South Texas Democratic elected officials who are looking to run in that South Texas district, and I look forward to supporting them.
University of Houston politics professor Brandon Roddinghouse says history is not in the Democrats' favor. The party effectively lost control of the state in the 90s.
The effort here seems to be to make the Democrats be exclusively an urban party. The districts that Republicans are drawing to try to maximize their gains include suburban areas, exurban areas, and rural areas.
But there's no guarantee what critics call gerrymandering will play out that way, at least in the near term. Polls show Latinos who voted for the GOP are turning against Trump over the economy and deportations. That could make the new maps riskier for Republicans than they think.
This is what some people call a dummy mander, right? Like you kind of inadvertently draw a map that ends up hurting.
Still, back in Seguin, Hernandez says Democrats have taken Texas Latino voters for granted. Now, he argues Republicans have given them a new opening, and his party needs to ramp up their game.
If Republicans weren't worried, they wouldn't be doing all this redistricting and stuff. So I think Democrats need to wake up and be active and vote.
The new GOP map could solidify the party's grip on Texas for years to come, especially if Democrats struggle to win back Latino voters in the state once solidly in their camp. Claudia Rizales, NPR News, Seguin, Texas, and parts beyond.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 18 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from Rapids Brewing Company, a place for gathering and community featuring live music multiple times a week, farm fresh food, and rotating beers from their own brew house. More information about their events, music, and menu available at rapidsbrewingco.com. Coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE KBXE news team. The History of Jazz airs Saturdays at noon and Sundays at 4 with host Paul Kibbe, exploring the distinctly American art form. Hear more jazz Sundays at 6 p.m. with volunteer hosted Jazz on America Avenue. And we receive support from the Watermark Art Center in downtown Bemidji with exhibits, classes, and handcrafted original art made by regional artists found in their shop 505. The center is accessible and open to the public, watermarkartcenter.org. The Friends of Lake Bemidji State Park have a pancake breakfast Sunday, August 31st from 8 to 10 at the park's dining hall. Bring your own plates and utensils to help the environment. The Cloquet Labor Day Parade is Monday, September 1st at 11 a.m. on Cloquet Avenue from 18th to 8th Street. There's also a car show from 10 to 3 at Dunlap Island. Native American Music and Arts Festival is Sunday, August 31st from 10 to 5 at the Mille Lacs Indian Museum and Trading Post near Onamia. There will be artists, demonstrations, live music, and food trucks. Happy Dancing Turtle near Pine River invites 4- and 5-year-olds to participate in the Tiny Turtles program this fall. Classes begin Monday, September 8th, and continue twice a month through November. Classes are held entirely outdoors. Find more info at happydancingturtle.org. Now back to All Things Considered.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs. With online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses at easycater.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Parents of children affected by the shooting this week at Annunciation Catholic School are fielding really challenging questions from their kids. Parents like Michael Burt, who has 5 children enrolled there.
I think the hardest question right now, there's so many. Telling my daughter that one of her best friends was killed. Why did this happen in church? Why did God let this happen?
Even for parents outside Minneapolis, talking with kids about what happened that day can be really hard. As NPR's Kadia Riddle reports, the most important thing, experts say, is to be truthful.
This would never happen to you. Not in your town, not in your school, not here. Those are the kinds of reassurances that parents want to give their children when something as senseless and terrible as a school shooting happens. But here's the problem in the United States. It could happen. School shootings have risen sharply in recent years. According to analysis from CNN, there have been 44 school shootings this year.
As parents, we want to protect our kids. And part of that protection is also not lying to them.
Melissa Breimer is director of terrorism and disaster programs at the UCLA Duke University National Center for Child Traumatic Stress.
When we give them blanket statements that this will never happen, if it ever does, then you're, what do I do now?
Another thing to avoid, hoping your child doesn't know about the school shooting and won't find out. Kids hear about things like this through social media and from their peers. It may be worse, says Breimer, if they've heard something and then their parents don't talk about it.
When we don't open up the door, we as adults almost make it like this is a taboo topic. And so then kids start protecting us adults because they think that we can't handle it.
There's no one script for talking to kids about gun violence. David Schoenfeld is director of the National Center for School Crisis and Bereavement. He says, start by asking your child what they've heard.
Allow them to share what their feelings are without trying to minimize or dismiss them.
Schoenfeld says it's important to listen to your child and give them the information they're asking for. Teens are likely to want more detail than younger kids.
Even children who are at quite some distance still hear about tragedy that happens and start to wonder what impact that might have on their lives or those of people that they care about.
That said, it's important not to overtalk or overexplain on these kinds of events, he says. There's a fine line between being transparent with them and being too graphic.
Best to start with a very simple explanation. And then you go with your child, taking the lead as to how much more you add.
It can be helpful to talk about the protections that are in place in their school. Remind them that the doors are secured or that their teachers have made contingency plans for this kind of thing. Schoenfeld says, though these conversations are difficult, they are critical.
You know, the thing is, if you talk to children about these types of events, it really sets you up to be able to talk with them about other difficult events in your life in the future. And it makes it more likely that they're going to come to you when there's something that they're worried about or upset about, because they know you can talk about it.
There's a lot of uncertainty in these situations. But one thing we do know, says Schoenfeld, difficult conversations will always be a part of life. Kadia Riddle, NPR News.
Call
College football has never had an opening weekend like this. Three matchups between top 10 teams. Plus, we'll get the starting debut of the most hyped player in a generation for one of the sport's most storied programs. Here to preview it all for us is NPR sports correspondent Becky Sullivan. Hi there.
Hi.
So, Becky, let's start off by talking about Arch Manning, the quarterback at Texas. And even if you don't know much of anything about college football, that's probably a name that sounds a little familiar.
Yeah. There's no more famous quarterback family than the Mannings. As you know, Arch is the grandson of Archie Manning, who was a beloved quarterback for the Saints back in the day. He's also the nephew of Peyton and Eli, who each, of course, won two Super Bowls. So, you know, no pressure for this 21-year-old kid. He committed to Texas a few years ago, but he has spent his first two seasons there sitting on the bench, and now he's the starter. His time has come.
Ooh, okay. It sounds like there might be just a little bit of pressure on Arch Manning.
Yes, I can't even begin to describe to you, Juana, the hype for this kid. Even last year, basically, every time Texas's old starter, you know, he got hurt a couple times or he'd throw a bad pass and you'd hear people just call for Arch Manning. And he did get a couple chances to play. He showed some flashes of something special, also showed some rookie mistakes. In total, he has thrown fewer than 100 passes in his entire collegiate career so far. And yet, Juana, he is already the betting favorite to win the Heisman. He is brushing that aside, I will say. Here's what he said about that this summer.
I'm not really in the business of this is going to sound mean, but like caring what other people think. But, you know, I'm grateful that y'all think that. But I've only played, what, two games, so I got a lot to prove.
So credit to him there. You can tell he's been raised by a family of professional athletes. He knows how to handle himself. He can talk to the media. He can present himself to the public. Of course, there's still the big question, which is, can he play football? And he's got his first huge test coming up tomorrow when Texas travels to Ohio to take on the defending national champs, Ohio State.
Okay, so you've got Texas-Ohio State as one of the weekend's big matchups. But then you've also got LSU playing Clemson, Notre Dame headed to Miami. All six of those teams that we're talking about, they're ranked in the top 10. That is a whole lot of great, exciting football for one weekend.
Totally. And reportedly the three top 10 matchups, supposedly the first time ever in college football for an opening weekend. And I think it's an emblem of the sort of big money era that this sport is in. You got these top tier matchups every weekend. Adding to that, the selection committee for the college football playoff announced last week that they're going to prioritize teams who play a tough schedule and who get these wins against ranked teams, as opposed to teams who sort of have an easier schedule, coast to 10 and 11 wins. That's all, you know, adding to this. It benefits teams, especially in the Big Ten and the SEC, which are sort of the ruling class of college football right now. You have all these powerhouse schools, Oregon, UCLA, Texas, Oklahoma, consolidating into joining these two conferences. You get more highly ranked matchups all season long. That leads to TV deals that can bring in these eye-popping sums of money. And now you have all these schools have to pay players. They get to pay players directly for the first time ever as a result of this legal settlement involving the NCAA this summer. Basically, Juana, there is no end to the amount of money flowing every which way in this sport right now.
And Becky, before we let you go, I do understand that there has been a notable retirement from college football this year, too. We have to talk about Ralphie.
Yes. Yeah. You're talking about Ralphie the Sixth, to be precise. Ralphie, as many people know, one of the most iconic mascots in college football. This is the live buffalo at Colorado. And Ralphies are always ladies, by the way, because their size and temperament are more agreeable. However, this Ralphie the Sixth, the school says, was, quote, indifferent to running, which is something I find very relatable. So she's retiring after just four seasons on the job. And although there is a Ralphie the Seventh in training, she's apparently not quite ready yet. So for now, the Buffs will be without their live mascot on the field, which is sad for them. But really, I think a tip of the hat is owed to the outgoing Ralphie. May her days be lazy and relaxing here on out.
That is truly my dream. NPR's Becky Sullivan, thank you.
You're welcome.
This is NPR News.
It is 529, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is the Up North Report. We receive support from Hibbing Chrysler Center, serving northern Minnesota, carrying Chrysler, Dodge, Jeep, and Ram vehicles with staff available to assist on the Beltline in Hibbing or at hibbingchrysler.us. Now it's time for the Up North Report from our KAXE KBXE news team.
For
For KAXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with the Up North Report. The nation's eyes remain on Minneapolis following Wednesday's deadly school shooting. Amid the calls for action, some stress that people should learn authentic ways to talk with and support survivors, even when the spotlight fades. Democratic leaders and parents gathered in Minneapolis on Thursday to renew calls to ban assault rifles. They echoed frustration over more innocent children losing their lives. Journalist Justin Agrello says it's important to make arguments using facts and data that these attacks shouldn't be a normal thing. But in a past project interviewing gun violence survivors in Chicago, he says he also learned more about the human aspect following a tragedy.
When someone experiences gun violence, it is the ultimate stripping of their agency. Whether they were a direct survivor or whether they lost a loved one, or in the case in Minneapolis, if they lost a child, right, or a sibling, they did not choose that.
Agrello says survivors can get some of that agency back when peers and loved ones or policymakers and support groups respect their wishes about how to discuss their experience. He says it doesn't mean walking on eggshells around them, but rather asking if it's okay to bring up a specific aspect of their grieving. He also says people shouldn't make assumptions about what a survivor needs and that checking first is best. Teacher Abby Clements is a survivor of the 2012 Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting and co-founder of Teachers Unify to End Gun Violence. She strongly believes access to guns is a factor that can't be ignored. She also agrees there needs to be a healthy balance in how the public processes these tragedies.
We know that statistics alone have not moved the needle. So we need to do better about creating space for stories.
Clement says her group aims to do that for educators, including the opportunity to speak anonymously. Meanwhile, Agrello hopes survivors aren't only called upon to share stories when there's a congressional hearing or a milestone anniversary. And he encourages the media and others to emphasize the accomplishments, interests, and aspirations of those who died from gun violence.
I think it's important to name not just how people died, but also how they lived.
Thanks to Minnesota News Connection for the story. A lab test has confirmed the death of a 3-year-old horse in Kitson County earlier this month was due to West Nile virus. The Minnesota Board of Animal Health reported the equine case was the first confirmed in the state this year, with 6 more confirmations of the mosquito-borne disease shortly thereafter. The other horses testing positive were in Fillmore, Lincoln, Wadena, Mille Lacs, and Wabasha counties. 5 of the 7 have died. In all cases, the animals were either unvaccinated or had an unknown vaccination history. Infected horses cannot spread the virus to people or other horses. The Minnesota Department of Health also recently announced it confirmed 20 cases of West Nile virus in humans so far this year, and 2 people have died. The Minnesota PCA will host a public informational meeting Wednesday in Virginia on the draft wastewater permits and variance request from U.S. Steel for its Keetac mine. The meeting will provide information about the agency's preliminary determination to deny the sulfate variance permit, as well as information about the Keetac mine and tailings basin permits and how to submit public comments. U.S. Steel estimated it would need to spend $814 million to comply with the state's sulfate standards. Minnesota has had the standards since 1973, designed to protect the state's wild rice resources, but it hasn't been strongly enforced. Meeting attendees who would like to provide an oral comment are expected to sign up at the door of the Iron Trail Motors Event Center between 5:30 and 6:15. U.S. Steel will host an open house before the meeting from 4 to 6, also at the Iron Trail Motors Event Center. A large audience is expected, and comments will be limited to 2 minutes. Attendees can also submit written comments at the meeting or online until September 22nd. Drivers around Wadena can expect a major change in construction traffic this weekend. Highway 10 will reopen with 1 lane each way. Drivers can expect lane shifts and no shoulders. Highway 71 in Wadena will close, with a detour posted on County Road 20. Access to County Road 92 off Highway 10 will remain closed for construction of a roundabout. Beginning Tuesday through mid-October, Highway 71 is expected to be closed, with a temporary all-way stop in place at County Road 20 and Juniper Avenue. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is sponsored by Woodland Bank, dedicated to serving local businesses, families, and nonprofits in our area since 1920. You can find more information online at woodland.bank.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Capital One, offering their premium travel card, Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its Sponsor Jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantFoundation.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. There are loads of movies out there about the beginning of a relationship. That first spark of attraction, that first sweet kiss. Well, how about a movie that tackles the other end, when it is all falling apart?
Okay, so today's session, the 10 things you love about each other. Theo, you first?
Sure. One. I would rather live with her than a wolf.
Did you say wolf?
Yeah.
Wow. One, he has arms. Well, I saw a documentary once about a man without arms, and it looked like a difficult life, particularly for the partner, so...
Yeah, that is what is happening when we meet Ivy and Theo in the new movie, The Roses. They are trying to save their marriage. No one thinks it's going to work, including their therapist.
I don't think you have the capacity to fix your problems.
Are you actually allowed to say that?
That seems unprofessional.
Yes, like malpractice.
We'll be expecting a hefty discount.
Time's up.
Now, as you can hear from that exchange, The Roses is a comedy, not a drama. Benedict Cumberbatch and Olivia Colman play the very unhappily married Theo and Ivy. In real life, the actors are buddies. And when they stopped by our New York bureau to talk with me about the film, I asked how two Brits playing two Brits came to make a movie set in Northern California.
This project was imagined around us. We're friends and have been for a long time and wanted to work with each other for a long time. So the idea of this film came about around getting us together. So, you know, it's a jumping off point. The War of the Roses, the great sort of iconic film, Kathleen and Michael in the 80s. But
people may be starting to put together. The title is The Roses. It is about a marriage that spectacularly falls apart. This is a remake of the 1989 classic with Kathleen Turner and Michael Douglas, War of the Roses.
But it's not a remake. I think we feel quite strongly about that. It's sort of a reimagining.
Inspired by?
Inspired very heavily by, because we loved that film.
Exactly.
The thing that your characters, as the marriage is collapsing, end up fighting over is the house. And to be fair, it is a pretty spectacular house. Describe the house.
Oh, well, it's just a beautiful, open...
Ivy paid for it.
Ivy paid for it.
It's a very embedded, as in sort of, it speaks to its location, embedded piece of architecture that sort of comes
on
out of this wilderness
cliff,
on a dramatic cliff.
The sea and the forest.
Exactly that. You're doing a better job than me. And it's surrounded by trees and bracken and this incredible vista that everything sort of walks towards and looks out over the North Pacific coastline of California.
But it's interesting. Why is that the thing they end up...
Because...
They don't fight over the kids. They don't fight over... There's a million things they could fight over. It's...
Because they're both invested in it, you know, massively.
And I think it's the thing that's, well, for you, it's your most precious thing. So it's the perfect weapon for Ivy.
It's basically him. You know, he's suffered this massive collapse of confidence and ego and everything with his literal collapse of his building, which is where his career nosedives.
Just to inject, Theo is an architect.
Yes.
He designs a building that literally collapses,
yes,
a giant one.
Exactly.
So this is his redemption
plan.
He's going to build the perfect house.
Exactly that. I get very overexcited, as often architects do, with various details, including expensive Irish moss as opposed to Californian moss. And, you know, things, the tension starts to escalate even in the build of it. And at the same time, our children earn these scholarships and we are empty nesters.
As this whole battle royale is playing out over the house, did you ever wish you could just say, oh, God, take it. Just take it and just go.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Well, yes. I suppose Ivy, as she says, she thinks Theo has stolen the children. And so she thinks, I'll steal his big child, his house. I mean, There are many moments, aren't there, when you could go, everybody stop, pause, count to 10. This could all be okay.
Yeah.
But that's, it wouldn't be quite as fun to watch.
They go beyond that
point. They sorted it out.
They really do. You know, I think they want to hurt each other by then.
Yeah.
That's the thing. That's the terrain.
I wanted to ask about a couple of specific scenes that I wondered if you each enjoyed playing with particular relish. Benedict Cumberbatch, there is a scene that involves your foot.
Oh, yeah.
A microplane and a dish that your wife is trying to prepare and serve at her restaurant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was fun. What else was fun? I mean, yeah, a lot of that kind of stuff was fun. The dinner party scene was extraordinary fun.
Yeah, it was both of our favourites, I think, wasn't it? I really loved flicking you in the forehead.
You liked flicking me in the eye. It's like, it was my eyelid.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, our forehead wouldn't have hurt as much. That's okay.
Your reaction was always just too funny.
I did throw an orange in your face, although it was a foam one. And that whole vice at the end, you know, I just...
Yeah, that's fun.
All that physicality in the comedy was great fun.
The dinner party scene, you get very drunk. Your character gets very drunk, Olivia Colman. You are absolutely savaging each other, and about half of your dinner guests get it and are appalled, and the other half are like, oh...
This is fun.
A new way to talk to your partner.
Yeah.
Let me join right in. Yeah. The scene at the very end, Olivia Colman, you are brandishing a gun. Without giving away quite how we get to this point or quite where it goes, just explain the scene for people who haven't seen it yet.
So a gun is gifted to us by our American friends much earlier in the film. And he just really pisses her off. So she gets the gun, says, I want you to get out. Because you've tried to kill me with raspberries.
I have tried to poison you with raspberries.
Yes,
your character's allergic to raspberries.
Desperately allergic. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he uses that to get her to try and sign over the deeds. And, you know, I think that's enough to push her over the edge. Yeah. A near-death experience. So yeah.
The gun is warranted at that point.
Yeah, and I'm not sure she means to shoot it, but it's got a hair trigger and it's quite delicate. And then it gets a little out of hand.
This serious, real question... Anything else you could whisper to those characters that you have learned over what I hope is the course of long, successful, very happy relationships where you think, I wish I could just tell them this?
Yeah. Well, I...
Not for public radio, no. But, yeah, don't have hard through fruit that you can throw at each other.
Yes.
Stick to bananas.
Yeah,
also, I heard there was a documentary about couples with extraordinary longevity in their relationships. And one guy said, sometimes it's about what you don't say. And initially when you hear that, you think, is that right? Is that good advice? And then, yeah, it is actually. Mm. So if you piss each other off one day, sometimes just wait till the next day. Mm. Just don't say it straight away. Mm. Find a calm moment, you know. And I think that was great advice. I remember hearing that and thinking, I'm going to try that.
One of our... long-standing female Supreme Court justices here was asked about the secret to a happy marriage, and her answer was, you can be a little bit deaf.
Yeah.
Selective hearing goes a long way in a marriage.
Yeah. I think that's true.
Yeah. Olivia Colman, Benedict Cumberbatch, this was a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Imagine me and you. I do. I think about you day and night.
It's only right
to think about the boy you love.
And holding tight,
so happy together.
If I should call you up,
invest a dime.
This is NPR News.
As he struggles to end war in Ukraine, President Trump has turned to boasting of reaching an ever-increasing number of peace agreements and ceasefires in other parts of the world.
We've stopped 7 wars, and really the number is actually 10.
But NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez says the reality of those peace agreements is not so black and white.
During the campaign, then-candidate Donald Trump would say in interview after interview that he would end the war in Ukraine in 24 hours. Here he is on Fox News back in 2023.
And there's a very easy negotiation to take place, but I don't want to tell you what it is because then I can't use that negotiation. It'll never work.
But whatever he tried, it didn't work as President Trump ran into the harsh realities of governing and diplomacy. Trump's, of course, not one to focus on his struggles. So a few months into his administration, Trump turned to touting his efforts to end other conflicts.
One Saturday, my administration helped broker a full
an immediate ceasefire, I think a permanent one, between India and Pakistan, ending a dangerous conflict of two nations with lots of nuclear weapons.
Lisa Curtis, a point person on South and Central Asia during the first Trump administration, says Trump deserves credit for the ceasefire between India and Pakistan.
Anytime you have two nuclear-armed countries in conflict, there is tremendous concern that it would escalate to the point of a nuclear exchange.
And while India contradicted the U.S. version of events, Curtis sees the May agreement as a turning point for Trump in how he looks at applying U.S. influence around the world.
I think when he saw, well, actually, the U.S. can play an influential role, and I can get credit for trying to stop some of these conflicts, you know, a light bulb went off.
It was a start of an evolution, as Curtis put it, that surprised a lot of people in diplomatic circles.
I love that President Trump wants to evaluate himself and have others do so by this particular metric.
Michael O'Hanlon, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, notes that most people associate Trump's America First policies with isolationism and kind of an indifference to other countries' challenges. And yet, while he credits Trump with having a positive influence on several of these conflicts, O'Hanlon says the administration is largely exaggerating its role.
Some of them are not even over. Others of them, you know, are very brittle in whatever peace may be taking shape. And still others, he had very modest roles in influencing, if any.
Trump and his team have cited his work around the world when advocating for the Nobel Peace Prize. Trump's chief envoy, Steve Witkoff, this week called Trump's efforts game-changing. Experts say Trump deserves credit for reducing tensions between Thailand and Cambodia, as well as Armenia and Azerbaijan. But fighting continues in the Democratic Republic of Congo, even after a peace agreement between the DRC and Rwanda, which Trump hailed as a, quote, glorious triumph for the cause of peace.
You know, peace has not broken out.
That's Michelle Gavin, a former U.S. ambassador to Botswana during the Obama administration. Sometimes it helps to announce agreements that can be used to apply pressure on the parties involved. But she says this feels like the Trump administration is prioritizing the announcement of a peace deal before peace actually arrives.
I'm very glad that this administration is not ignoring the crisis in Central Africa, but it just seems like a real race to declare mission accomplished before the hard work has been done.
And she wonders whether this administration has the appetite for the dogged diplomacy that she says is required to make sure these announcements are fulfilled. Franco Ordonez, NPR News, The White House.
This is NPR News.
It is 5:48, and you're tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Support for this program comes from Sanford Health, with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the Upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. Ripple River Gallery, south of Deerwood, hosts the dual exhibit Reclaimed Reframed, now through September 28th, featuring sculptures from KAXE's own John Bauer, paired with photographs from Rachel Kane. The exhibit proves that one person's trash is another person's treasure. Open Wednesday through Saturday from 10 to 5, and Sundays 11 to 4. We receive support from ICTV. Stay tuned, stay connected with ICTV. Learn more at watchictv.com. Thanks to our listeners, we've raised over $162,000 during this crisis caused by federal cuts to public media. KXE is working hard to keep the programming you love going strong. Every action helps. Donate, share our work, or buy a ticket to Grand Rapids Riverfest. Visit KAXE.org. Itasca County Habitat for Humanity offers a financial foundations course beginning September 8th. The class meets once a month through January and helps build knowledge so you can make informed financial decisions and achieve long-term goals. Call Itasca County Habitat to register. The Tally Gallery at Bemidji State University hosts a new retrospective exhibit of work by Marley Call. There's an opening reception Thursday, September 4th from 4 to 7 at the gallery located in Bridgman Hall on the BSU campus. This exhibit looks back at Call's 60-year artistic journey with some never-before-seen works. It will be on display through October 30th. Now we'll take you back to All Things Considered here on member-supported KAXE KBXE.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. 17 months ago, Matt Boyer found himself at the center of a storm. It involves the most famous baseball player in the world, Shohei Ohtani, his interpreter, Ippei Mizuhara, more than $300 million in sports wagers, and allegations of theft. Boyer, an illegal bookmaker, couldn't talk about any of it at the time he was facing criminal charges. But today, in federal court in Southern California, Boyer was sentenced to just over a year in prison, a result that gave him an odd bit of freedom. It allowed Boyer to speak in depth about the scandal for the first time. From California, Keith O'Brien has the story.
Few players are more electrifying than Shohei Ohtani.
Here's a 2-1.
There was a time not that long ago when Matt Boyer lived for moments like this one. As an illegal bookmaker in Southern California, Boyer had about 1,000 people betting with him, dozens of agents working for him, and millions of dollars moving every week.
That's why people bet with me. They were getting paid. They know if they won, they're getting paid.
But last fall, when Ohtani and the Los Angeles Dodgers won the World Series, Boyer's house was quiet. Football season was quiet, too. Boyer, a man who once watched every game, wasn't watching sports at all because he had been caught up in the biggest sports gambling controversy in decades.
We begin at 3 with the scandal that's rocking the sports world.
In an interview at his home earlier this year, Boyer retraced his steps, recounting how he ended up here. It began, he said, in the early 1990s when he was just 16 years old. He was running a poker ring and a bookmaking operation out of his mother's house. One of his friends was soon into him for $300, and Boyer was in trouble for the first time.
So his mom called my mom, and we had an intervention at my house. I'll never forget it. I came home, and there was four moms in my living room.
The poker ring ended that day. The bookmaking did not. It continued into Boyer's adult years, worrying his wife, Nicole, especially after the birth of their son in 2021.
In my mind, I did not want my son to grow up with a dad that did something not legal for a living.
But by then, Boyer's operation had grown. The money supported a lavish lifestyle, and his clients were sometimes famous. Several, he said, were professional athletes.
I'd speculate that 10 of them were baseball players.
Boyer was getting close to them. And one night in September 2021, he said he and one of his agents, a man named Mike, got invited to a poker game involving players and coaches for the Los Angeles Angels. It was Shohei Ohtani's team at the time, and Boyer said that Ohtani's interpreter, Ippei Mizuhara, joined the poker game too.
And we all went in there and ordered pizzas, and we were playing poker. And Ippei was on his phone betting on a sports app, and I don't know which one. And it might have been a legal one, illegal, I don't even know. And Mike saw that and said, hey, you know, Matt does that if you needed a spot to play.
It was standard procedure for Boyer. He was just recruiting a new player. But Mizuhara was not a standard client. According to court records, Mizuhara's statements, and Boyer's memory, Mizuhara immediately began betting with Boyer and losing a lot.
There had to be zero handicapping on what he was picking. And the parlays were just long shots. I mean, you might as well just took 10 grand and lit it on fire.
The losses mounted, millions of dollars. And when it was time to start paying up, the wire transfers came in from the bank account of Shohei Ohtani.
The minute I saw a wire transfer with the name of Shohei Ohtani was the moment I said, holy this is good and bad.
Federal investigators later determined that Ohtani had nothing to do with the gambling. Mizuhara was stealing from his friend, they said, even impersonating Ohtani in phone calls to the bank.
Who am I speaking with?
Shohei Ohtani.
Thank you. How may I help you?
I tried to make a wire transfer a couple days ago.
But Boyer didn't know any of that. He just knew that he had tapped into a seemingly bottomless account. Ohtani was about to leave the Angels and sign a $700 million deal with the Dodgers. Boyer admitted to boasting about his ties to the player and conversations with other gamblers. And Boyer was talking at a dangerous time. Unbeknownst to him, the feds were already closing in.
It was just out of left field, I guess would be the category I would put it.
Chris Seymour was a special agent in criminal investigations at the Internal Revenue Service in the summer of 2023 when he first learned about Boyer's bookmaking. At the time, he had no knowledge of Ippei Mizuhara.
It was not where we were going. It was not where we were looking. And all of a sudden, you got this line drive, and like, wow, I guess we got to follow that one.
In October 2023, Seymour and other federal agents raided Boyer's Southern California home in San Juan Capistrano. Seymour left that day with a mountain of evidence against Boyer. And while that was frightening for Matt and Nicole, it was nothing compared to what happened next. When news broke that Mizuhara was one of Boyer's clients, reporters descended on the house. Nicole said it got to the point where she could barely walk outside.
They come with cameras. They come right in your face. They hide behind cars. I'm trying to put my son in the car, and they're just right in your face trying to film everything you're doing, asking if Shohei Ohtani was betting or if we knew anything. It was a lot. It was a lot to take in.
Now that it's over, with Ohtani cleared of wrongdoing, Mizuhara sentenced to almost 5 years in prison, and Boyer receiving his own sentence today, Nicole Boyer considers it all a blessing. Her husband isn't a bookmaker anymore. He's a dad, playing with his son on the floor of the house where he once ran his bookmaking operation.
No.
Okay, get over here.
He's also trying something new. In recent months, Matt Boyer has written a book, and he has started telling his story in public for the first time.
I think we should give these guys a nice hug.
One day last February, he spoke about his mistakes at an ethics and accounting class at the University of Southern California. And afterwards, many students came down to the stage to talk to him.
I'm sorry, man, but like, oh, don't be sorry, Dodgers fan. Yeah. And I remember seeing your name on like the articles.
They had questions about gambling, about Mizuhara, and about Ohtani. But mostly, they just wanted to say that they had met the bookie at the center of it all. For NPR News, I'm Keith O'Brien in Los Angeles.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for dedicated and forward-thinking individuals to join their growing team. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. yptc.com/NPR. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. Support for KAXE comes from Itasca County Health and Human Services, hosting the 17th annual Community Connect on Thursday, September 18th from 11 to 3 at Yanmar Arena in Grand Rapids.